I've had the privilege of reading Simon Sebag Montefiore's latest book, The World, A Family History. I've managed to get my hands recently on his book, Jerusalem, which tells the history of that part of the world through conquest and empire and also through to current day politics. I've been a very, very big fan of his on podcasts, on documentaries, particularly in his way of telling the story of human history. But he's in South Africa currently to promote his magnificent new book, History of the World. It's called The World, A Family History. And he will be speaking and will be giving the keynote at the 2023 Jewish Literary Festival, which is on today. Simon Sebag Montefiore, thank you so much. I hope I don't sound too much of a fanboy, and I hope you don't take offense to what you've been called. You're a historian, but also you've managed to bridge that gap between a pop favorite, but also telling the historic story of humanity. Good morning, and thanks
Good
so much
morning.
For being.
Good morning. It's great to be here in Cape Town, Lester, and great to be on your show. And I don't mind that at all. I mean, I write these books to be read by people who don't even have to know any history to enjoy them, I hope.
So you don't mind being called a pop historian?
I don't care. Anyone can call me anything, providing they read the books.
You're probably maybe to the point of nausea having to retell what this book is about. I've read and I've listened to so many podcasts already, but you every day you're introduced to a new audience, introduced to Simon Sebag Montefiore, reintroduced to this world, this book, but a world history through the prism of family. How do you embark on this project to say, I want to put 1,300 pages into a book telling the story of world history, but I want to use the prism of families?
Yeah, I mean, I always wanted to write a world history that was more accessible. A lot of world histories, they have all sorts of huge convergences and divergences and migrations and technical inventions, but they miss the people. Mm. And then biography, I love biography, but biographies have almost too much focus on one person. So I wanted to combine the two so that it would have the span of world history, but the intimacy, the juice, the grit of biography. And I realized that family was the best way to do that, because we all have a family. Families are fascinating. We all watch Game of Thrones or Succession. Mm. And, you know, people in reviewers in England, several reviewers have said this is Game of Thrones meets Succession. And I'm not at all embarrassed about writing something that could be described like that. In fact, I want people to enjoy the history.
We enjoy even the fictionalized history. You mentioned Game of Thrones. We enjoy watching The Crown for some reason. Not necessarily because we hark about monarchy, but because there's a family involved. I remember the recent miniseries, The Kennedys, which tells the story of the Kennedy clan. We're fascinated by family.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the Kennedys are in this. I mean, the Kennedys are in this book. I mean, you'll know many of the families that are in this book. I mean, all the kind of the Borgias, the Kennedys, the Plantagenets, the Zulu dynasty. There are a lot of African dynasties in the book, so it's very much an African history as well. Mm. But you'll know a lot of them, but there are a lot you won't know. And there are a lot of places you won't be familiar with. I mean, for example, it's not just about great empires and kingdoms. It's also got Haiti and Hawaii and Cambodia and Albania and a little bit about England. Not much, because I'm much more interested in Africa and Asia, because that's what's been missing from histories lately, I feel.
But the story of this book starts in England, a dried seabed where the first prehistorical remnants of what we could call a family, of course, in Africa. We find the remnants of prehistoric man, yeah. But in terms of the story of the family, it's footprints in a dried seabed.
That's right.
That where your story starts.
Yeah, because there are much older remains in Africa, of course, when Africa's where it all started. But I was looking for a family, and this family at Habsburg, which is in Norfolk in England, it happens to be in England, but it could be anywhere. It was about 950,000 years ago, and it's a family of footprints. And so and it's just been discovered quite recently. Mm. And when I read about it, I said, that's the beginning of the book. That's perfect, because, you know, that sums up what I'm trying to do. And it's quite a weird thing I was trying to do. And I wanted to see if it would work when I started writing it. I laid out on my kitchen table a huge bit of paper, and I started to map out the mega families that are at the center of the book to see if this whole crazy idea would work. It was the beginning of lockdown. I mean, this is a lockdown book.
Yeah.
I wrote it as a prisoner, more like a monk, living like a monk in a monastery
dipping your quill
style.
In ink with a candle.
Yeah.
But it's a story that starts 900,000 years ago, but goes up until a year ago.
Yes.
Start of the Ukraine war. Of course, you need time to write, you need time to edit and publish and print and all that. But why say a year ago? Why the Ukraine war? I know you've previously written about Russo affairs, and you've written books on Stalin, and you're quite fascinated by Russia and its culture, and particularly its intersection now with Ukraine. Why say, okay, from 900,000 years ago to a year ago, almost exactly at the start of the Ukraine war?
It's a really good question. I mean, one reason is that I was very lucky myself in my own life. I've sort of, especially in Russia, I was there for the breakup of the Soviet Union, and I was a war correspondent in a lot of the wars there, Chechnya and other places. And so I've known a lot of the characters, the historical characters. And one of the things I've done in this book is use some of the historical characters I've known in my life. And I don't make a big thing of it, but I just say, as they said to the author. So I've got, Thatcher and Kissinger and a few, Shevardnadze, the foreign minister of Gorbachev, who I knew quite well. I flew round with him. So I've got some interesting characters that I knew. And I wanted to put some of my own adventures in these wars, in the breakup of the Soviet Union, in the book, which I've done. And I had to bring that up to modern times to do that. And so I've done that. But I was going to finish the book on the first day that someone died of COVID in Wuhan. Mm. But when the war started, I've written so much about that region and that area, and I sort of, Putin actually read my book on Russia, and when it came out 23 years ago, my first history book, which was called Catherine the Great and Potemkin. Catherine the Great and Potemkin were the lovers, the partners, who wrote amazingly sexy letters about power and love and eroticism, but also conquered Ukraine and Crimea. So Putin was very interested in that when it came out 23 years ago. And I realized that he was going to invade Ukraine, perhaps before a lot of other people did. And of course, I had to put it in the book because it's changed the whole world. It's recalibrated the whole world.
So let's talk maybe on the current geopolitics and the influence. More than 100 years ago, the world changing, or that part of the world, or this aspect of our world, starting with the assassination, with the execution of the Romanov family. Where does the Romanov family fall into the story of Russia, and now in 2023, the story of the world?
Well, that's such a good question. I mean, the fact is, the Romanovs are so important now. Because I wrote a book about the Romanovs. What's fascinating about it is that Putin is really self-consciously channeling the Romanov dynasty and also the great rulers of the Soviet Union, of which there was only one, Stalin. And Stalin, as we know, killed a lot of people, but he was also the most successful ruler Russia's had for 200 years. And he expanded the empire into the whole of Eastern Europe. He took Berlin. But he was always aware also of the Romanovs and the Tsars. And when someone congratulated him on taking Berlin, he said, yes, but Tsar Alexander I took Paris. So he was always thinking about, expanding the empire. And Russia was founded by Peter the Great as an expanding empire. And the problem with Russia is that they've never really recalibrated. They've never really reconceived the idea of the Russian state as anything other than empire. And so Putin is really channeling those great czars like Peter the Great, Catherine the Great. She's a woman, but By the way, this book is filled with fascinating women, but that's another story. But
I want to get to the matriarchal side, but let's take a step back. We spoke about the Romanovs. The Romanovs connected to the broader Habsburg dynasty, cousins of the Habsburgs, you know, ruling the great countries of Europe, from Russia to Greece to Northern Europe, and of course to Great Britain. The Habsburg dynasty forms part as a leg of the Romanov story as well.
That's right. Well, all these families are interconnected. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the great families that I cover in the book in Europe goes right from Charlemagne, in the sort of Middle Ages, right up to the Habsburgs, who fell in 1918, and then there's the Romanovs, and of course there's the British royal family, the Windsors, and they're all cousins, they're all interconnected, but actually many of these great families are interconnected. Like, for example, you know, one of the big families we've got is the Genghis Khan family. Now that's just fascinating, but they link up with the Tamerlane family, which that goes on to rule India. So this book is very much covers, you know, in India, China, Russia, Africa, South America, in a way that I don't think has been done before. Yeah. And I must say, Lester, it almost killed me writing this book. You can imagine. God. I mean, you can imagine. I didn't sleep for 3 years.
1,300 pages.
I didn't sleep for 3 years. Oh, I mean, I've barely made it here, Lester.
Well, I'm glad you are. Simon Sebag Montefiore, his amazing book, it's called The World of Family History, telling 900,000 years of human history using the family as the prism. He's speaking at the Jewish Literary Festival from today. He's giving the keynote address. Let's talk about strong matriarchal dynasties, women leaders. I am very much buoyed that this part of our human history comes to light, but also at the same time, a little bit disturbed of, even though we have strong matriarchal governance structures, that often sexual violence, torture is often used also against women to repress and hold down even members of your own family if you happen to be a girl child. And that has been a bit of a distressing part of comes to light in this book.
Well, actually, I mean, we all know from our own families that families are a mixture of nurturing love, but also, you know, deep jealousies and rivalries, even in families that don't include kingdoms and empires. And, you know, obviously throw in power and nothing so corrupts and corrodes a family love than power. And traditionally, that often meant that, you know, sons were killed or killed each other's, brothers killed each other. We're seeing a bit of that kind of rivalry in real life in England at the moment. But also, you know, daughters were used, you know, to sent away at very young age. I mean, Catherine the Great was 14 when she was sent to Russia on, you know, virtually on her own. And they're sent off to be married to terrible people. As pawns, really, in the great political game. So very tough. But this book also has a lot of cases of quite extraordinary cases where enslaved women are in fact married into a harem in the Ottoman Empire or somewhere, and actually rise to rule the whole empire, which is quite extraordinary. Of course, didn't happen to most women or girls who experienced enslavement. Most of them that didn't happen, but exceptions did happen. And I think you'll see from the women who are in the book, some of them very famous, Indira Gandhi and Thatcher and Mrs. Mandela, for example, who was formerly married to President Michelle of Mozambique, is one of them. But you'll see from this that many of them are wonderful, talented, peace-loving, but a lot of them are just as brutal, incompetent, and vicious as men.
You're quite confident of an African and South Asian history. Names like the Khamas of Botswana, the Kenyattas, political dynasty, Uhuru Kenyatta just finishing a second year term, his father being the founding president of Kenya, the Misizulus here in South Africa. You pay quite close attention to also the African, South American even, largely untold histories that move away from simply the Western paradigm of history.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. One of the great things about history at the moment is it's become much more diverse. And actually, it's much better history, too. So I've taken a real joy in telling African stories. And it's just in Southern Africa, yeah, there are a lot of families that you'll recognize. The Zulus are the most famous, but there are lots of others. We have the Sotus, we have the Khoisas, we have the Shonas in Zimbabwe, we have many others, all the way up Africa. We have East Africa, we have people like Haile Selassie in Ethiopia. In West Africa, we've got, you know, all sorts of the kingdoms, the Dahomey Kingdom, the Benin Kingdom, the Mali, the Ghanas. I mean, these are all the Congos. Mm. You know, I've taken a real delight in trying to master the stories of Africa. Mm. And some of the empires are European empires, but they're also Arab empires. You know, the Said the Great of Oman. I mean, most people probably don't know this story, but what the greatest empire in East Africa, which ruled is that Tanzania, Kenya, all the way down to Mozambique, was ruled by the sultans of Oman in Arabia. And they ruled that for a long time, and it was a slaving empire before the Europeans even. So, African history is fascinating, and it's a joy to tell it.
And that empire splitting because it was father dies, and we split the East African part of this empire, and we split that from the Omani Empire on the Arab Peninsula.
That's right.
And that thing gets split. And those are the schisms then between families that then continue and push forward world history. But we've moved on from largely to a democratic dispensation from, 100 years ago, countries embracing democracy. But politics nowadays somewhat seems to follow some sort of monarchical structure. The sons of former politicians, we spoke about the Kennedy dynasty. We can talk about the Clintons, for example, the Bushes, for example. Has politics replaced the monarchical structure of reigning kings and queens whose sons and daughters then take their positions, and we just simply replace them with politicians?
Yeah, well, I mean, what happened after 1945 was many of the new countries in Africa and Asia, they look like democracies. They have presidencies, legislatures, elections, but actually many of them are sort of, for all intents and purposes, monarchies. Some of them are actually hereditary monarchies, like in Syria or North Korea. The North Korean, I mean, I tell the story of the Kim dynasty, which is the most powerful single family in the world because they have nuclear weapons, which is quite something for a family to own, isn't it? But, you know, but in Africa, for example, you also have what I call demo dynasties, where you can elect them, but they're often the sons of leaders, but you can unelect them too, get rid of them as well. So you have the Kenyattas, which you mentioned, and the Khamas in Botswana, who are rather an admirable family, I have to say. You know, so Seretse Khama is one of the great African leaders, I think. One of the great successes. Jomo Kenyatta is really important. We have Nkrumah, but his son, he was overthrown before he could have any sons to succeed to the presidency. But there is also a dynastic resurgence going on in the world where people are bringing their sons into power. And you only have to look at Asia. You know, President Xi of China is the son of a leader. You know, in Pakistan, it's completely a dynastic government now.
Bongbong Marcos
just got elected in Philippines. You know, everywhere you look, there are these dynasties being formed. Often, I mean, in Uganda, that's another example. You know, his son has just been promoted to heir. In Cambodia, the Hun Sen has just promoted his son to heir. I mean, there's something happening, and I think it is the failure of these kind of democratic structures that look democratic, but actually don't provide what people feel they need, which is what's all this about, really? It's about providing security and stability. That's what people want from political systems. Yeah. All political systems are designed to do that, aren't they? To provide safety, predictability, security, prosperity in a kind of crazy, unpredictable world. And democracies, we always thought democracies was the right way to do that. But is it?
I'd like your take on the phenomena of what the modern parlance calls the phenomena of the failed son. It is the underachieving son of the politician. We can use Eric and Donald Trump Jr., for example. Yes. Stalin's son, I forget his name.
What, yeah, Vasily.
Vasily was, he hijacked the Russian ice hockey team, and he was known to enjoy drink then in following his dad's footsteps. We can talk about...
That's right, yes.
We could argue that George W. Bush is probably the most successful failed son of a former president. What is the phenomena of people who've been prepared for certain levels of either political or governance life simply just not making the cut, the disappointment of the successful or powerful?
Well, there's nothing more terrible than being the son of a great man, I think. Mm. And the other side of it is when you look at these great men like Churchill and Stalin, they could govern everything. They could control everything. And the only thing they couldn't control in the world was their own children. Mm. And no one can control their own children. So Stalin's son was a great example. You mentioned Vasily. He was promoted to general. But Stalin was always embarrassed about him. He used to do stupid things. Like when he went fishing, instead of fishing with a fishing rod, he fished with a grenade. So he just threw the grenade into the river. And, of course, that killed one of his soldiers, which was a huge scandal. Mm. So he was an absolute idiot. But Stalin was never going to have him succeed. And in Russia today, there's no sort of... Putin doesn't have a son, luckily. Mm. But there's no sign of him trying to set up a family regime. Though their dynasty is really the KGB connection. But that's another sort of... That's the new nobility.
And that is... Family can be beyond biological. It could be a grouping, like a...
An entourage,
a post-liberation movement, because as a liberation movement, we are family, not necessarily by blood, but by cause, and that could also be an extension of what we call.
I look at this as sort of coteries, entourages, group cabals, which are sort of which can be formed by a liberation struggle. I mean, in the ANC, you may have that, for example. You may be thinking of that. And certainly in other liberation movements in Africa, you get these tiny clique of people. Normally, they fall out and kill each other along the way. But that's another story. Mm. But you're right. This is a fascinating phenomenon. But you're right. George W. Bush is the most successful ne'er-do-well son of all time. Though he was, I think the Iraq War was a pretty catastrophic decision, which was still paying for, by the way, all these years later. And I mean, the book ends with, ends with the modern world. It ends with Saudi Arabia and the Bushes and Trump and the Trumps.
Mm. Running out of time, but I needed to ask this question. Who, in your opinion, has been the most important, most impactful family in history? It's probably very difficult to determine, but I want you to wage on your opinion from the Julio-Claudian dynasty, the Mings, the Medicis, the Habsburgs, and even let's bring it, the Rothschilds, along with all its conspiracy junk that comes along with that. Who has been the most important, impactful family in human history?
You're putting me on the spot. I am. Okay, I'm going to answer. I think the most important history... the most important historical family is the family of the Prophet Muhammad, because you'll see in the book that that family is right at the center of world history and right at the center of this book. And there were three huge dynasties that ruled much of Western Asia and North Africa, the Umayyads, the Abbasids, and the Fatimids. And so and there are members of that family that still rule Jordan today. So the one family has ruled all the way through. And by the way, if you ask me, and I think, Lester, I'm just advising you this, if you had to choose one period to live in history, you would join me at the Abbasid court in Baghdad in the 9th century. It was the wildest, most decadent, most pleasure-loving. The music was best. The food was best. The poetry was best. That's where you want to be if you could choose anywhere.
Really appreciate it. Simon Sebag Montefiore is speaking at the Jewish Literary Festival today. His book, and it's been a pleasure having him in studio. It's called The World, A Family History, 1,300 pages of amazing human history told through the prism of families. Simon, you're off to Joburg also after this with a book tour there. So if any of our Joburg listeners are listening to us online, please go look out for Simon Sebag Montefiore. Simon, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. What fun this has been.